He's the only one that sees everything. He sees how the infielders move and why they move, and he figures it out. And if Gehringer moves to his right and you don't know why, you ask him, and or why the outfielders gang up, and why the pitchers do what they're doing because you're the catcher.
Mm-hmm.
So that I said that in Chores, and 20 years later or more, one of the writers in New York, whom I was not a great admirer of, wrote me a letter and said, "I thought you said managers couldn't manage." And Freddie Hutchinson had just won the pennant for St. Louis. And this guy kept it in his head for all that length of time, waiting for a pitcher to win. So that there are pitchers now who are doing an outstanding job. And mm-hmm. It's a different game now. And I just feel like the advantage is with the catcher, only because if you want an immediate fix, the catcher can walk in there and know exactly what to do technically. But that's only a small part of managing. You've got to manage people, you've got to manage front offices. And therefore, I would say yes and no. But more yes than no.
But rarely do you ever find an outfielder who becomes a big league manager, because they're away from all the action and the conversations.
I suppose they if they get the publicity, they have to be a great ball player.
Mm-hmm.
And great ball players don't particularly like to manage. They have, but they don't really like it. On the other hand, you take an infielder who, like Alex Grammas, and a catcher like Torrey and Crandall, mm-hmm. and you go right down through the thing. They might not be great ball players,
mm-hmm.
but they are attractive to people who want somebody who understands the game. I think for that reason, the outfielders do not concentrate on managing, and the other guys do.
They kind of, if there's some conversation around the mound, they're still out there waiting until it gets over and the batter comes up. In our last meeting, you said that, at least when you were managing, that managing the stars of the team was the most important thing. Everything else fell into its place. What do you mean by that? Because I think you'd have to manage everybody because everybody wanted to be out on the field.
Well, you know, you can't put managing in a test tube. If you were going to do that, if you thought that there was a book on managing,
I would go out and buy it.
You would, that's right. You'd write it. You would say, well, Casey Stengel doesn't belong in it because Walter Austin is a different type of guy.
Yeah.
And Lopez is mild, and Cochran was crazy. You go, I don't mean crazy. I mean he was a competitive.
Yeah.
And you go all the way down through Danny Murtaugh and Eddie Stanky, and each one was a different type.
Mm-hmm.
But each one was able to handle a pitching staff, or he had to go home.
Tell me what you mean. Okay, let's take...
I mean that if you have the pitching, or if you can create pitching out of what you have, and you can get the trust of your entire pitching staff, then you can do the kind of a job that's supposed to be done. I think that you have to have meetings with your pitchers and catchers together.
Separate from the other team?
I believe that. And unlike the old days when they had meetings of the whole ball club, and all you got in then was arguments and... And outfielders knowing they're supposed to pitch a guy low, and you pitch one high, and a guy hit it, and the outfielder came in and said, where was that pitch? You know, that's a fight. So that I would ask the pitchers at first, the catchers, because that was Cochran's and Lopez's style, and the pitchers then meet. And then if you have a pitcher who's been around for a while and you were talking about a hitter, you would say, how are you going to pitch to Stanky? And the pitcher would say, well, the first couple of times up, he tries to pull me.
Mm-hmm.
And when he's up and they need a run, he's trying for a base on balls, and he'll hit me straight away more than he will mm-hmm. pull me. So if you bunch him in the outfield, I think I'd like it better, you know. A guy with a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, you know, what the hell, you pull him all over to the opposite field because nobody can pull him anyway. But I think that an experienced pitcher has the right, in spite of all of the statistics that are placed before him, to tell you how he's going to pitch a guy when he's going to lose a game. And the defense proper with that thought in mind.
So where does the manager come in if the pitcher said, this is the way I'm going to pitch him, and you disagree?
Well, let me give you an example of that. We were talking one day in the first part of a year, and Cochran was the manager.
This is the Tigers.
Yeah, in the 30s. And there was a guy in our meeting who was on our ball club who had just played against the hitter that we didn't know. And let's say it was Morgan. Cochran would say, well, he played last year in Toledo, and you pitched against him quite a bit, Harry. What did you do? And he said, well, we tried the jammer. And Cochran said, did everybody try to jam him on your club? And he said, yes. And Cochran said, then we'll pitch away from him. And everybody laughed, and Cochran said, look, if this guy hit 350, you had to be pitching him wrong.
That's right.
So that a catcher who's been around a long time knows exactly what a pitcher can do against a hitter. Because it's happened many, many, mm-hmm. many times. Same hitter, same pitcher. Okay. But there comes a time when a pitcher is going to change that pattern. And if he has got the background, and it's a winning run in the balance,
mm-hmm.
then he has the right. He has earned the right to decide what he's going to throw. Now, it's a funny thing to say that a manager will not agree to let a guy do something he wants to do. But
I see all the time now, Bertie, where the catcher's looking, like in the World Series, the catcher's looking over the dugout, he's getting a signal from the, what they call the bench coach now, or from the manager, he's flashing it out there. It's like football, watching the coach from the sideline, he's calling every pitch. That's quite different from what you're telling me.
Yeah, well, if they're looking in for a pitch, I think it's wrong.
Well, that's what I saw in the World Series over and over again in the playoff.
You might have been looking for a pitch, but
oh.
It could also have been for a pitch-out.
Okay.
To set up a situation.
Okay.
The difference between the pitch-out now and in the old days, and this is too bad, is that a hitter doesn't get the right to put on his own hit and run. Appling was famous, and nobody could ever figure out his hit and run. The catchers would talk to each other mm-hmm. about Luke. Mm-hmm. Talk to each other. And I said to him one time, Luke, let me ask you a question. What was your hit and run sign? And he said, with most of them, I just said, you run and I'll hit.
Keep it simple.
Yeah, so that you had to remember when you were going to pitch out. And you had to try to get the batter's sign. And you had to get... I just believe that in the case of a hit and run, if they have the sign,
mm-hmm.
yes. But I don't see any reason for pitching out when the guy's not running.
Yeah.
That only says to me that a pitcher is out there and he's saying to himself, I'm going to pitch this guy low and away, and I'm going to try to give him a little crossfire, and all of a sudden the catcher puts down the pitch out. And the pitcher knows it comes from the bench, so he pitches out.
Mm-hmm.
And now he gets his concentration back and says, I can't pitch that guy that way now. I'm behind. So I've got to do this. And what you're doing, and I'm only talking about baseball as the way it should be played. What you're doing is you're destroying the concentration of the pitcher.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. When a pitcher is thinking a certain way, I always said that there was never a pitcher that I caught that I couldn't hit. And I proved it.
Really?
When I was, yes.
How'd you prove it?
I knew what he was thinking. I knew it. I caught him. And I caught him the way he wanted to pitch.
You mean there's a certain rhythm
a
or
report.
A pattern of pitches?
A guy can only pitch a certain way.
You mean the body movement?
Well...
Or the kind of pattern of fastball
stuff? I just know that if a pitcher is thinking, I'm going to pitch this guy high, and the catcher calls for a curveball, then one of them is wrong.
Yes.
And if the catcher keeps calling the pitch, when the pitcher wants to throw the curveball and he calls for the fastball, the pitcher is going to step back. And if the game has been successfully operated, then nothing is said. But all of a sudden, the catcher gets hurt or the catcher is given a day's rest. And another guy goes in there to catch him. And every time he thinks fastball, he gets the fastball sign. Well, you know that he's going into the manager and say, hey, the next time I pitch, I'd like to pitch to birdie.
Yeah.
And it's pretty hard for a manager to not allow that. It's also impossible for him to let them do that when the guy he's got catching him is a strength.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are great pitchers. And I can think of one in Philadelphia who would only pitch to McCarver. And McCarver won before he caught him, and the guy won after he caught him.
Mm-hmm.
But he just felt comfortable with McCarver. I'm positive that McCarver could have walked up against him and hit him. Because he was in tune. He was absolutely in tune with that guy.
Mm-hmm. So they really
That's what I meant when I said that.
But how about, you know, let's go back to your days you using some of those thoughts when you went up with Cleveland as manager in 54, I believe.
Right.
Stayed with them until about August of 58.
Right.
Now, you had a powerhouse of a team.
Yes,
I mean, you had guys slugging that baseball all over the place.
The record.
Well, you tied the New York Giant record of, what, 220?
220,
wasn't it? Until the Yankees broke it in 1961, which I think is 240 or 241. But anyway.
Yeah, I think I have a ring that they gave us, and the ring says...
212?
I don't know.
Okay, whatever.
212,
you know, 212 or 220, yeah. I mean, that's a lot of home runs.
Yeah, I don't know where the ring is in the vault.
Oh. There, you know, your teams were known as hitting teams rather than pitching teams. And, you know, you came close to winning a pennant. You were manager of the year one of those years. So here you had Kulusevski, you had Crow came up, George Crow. You had Wally Post, Gus Bell. Frank Robinson came up under your tutelage. That was the question then, how am I going to handle all these sluggers and give them a chance and make them feel comfortable as opposed to worrying about your pitching staff? So
well,
then you have to concentrate then more on
you
your...
You know, when you're managing, it's kind of like you're in a card game and they deal you a hand and you have to play the cards that are dealt to you.
You had no choice about who you're going to have on the team?
Not when you get there. When I walked out of Indianapolis into Cincinnati, do you think change Kulusevski or Temple? I gave Temple a chance he would not have otherwise gotten, but McMillan is the best fielding shortstop I ever saw.
Yeah.
And the ball club's philosophy was built around power. The ball park was designed for power. And therefore, all you needed in that case was a closer, a great closer. And the 1 year that I had the great closer, we went into the last 3 days of it with a chance to win it.
Yeah.
And I don't believe there was ever a better closer than Herschel Freeman. I saw him pitch in Louisville, and we got a chance to get him, and we got him. And his career was so short because, unfortunately, he hurt his arm. And in those days, there was no medical means that we knew of to take care of the arm in Herschel.
Mm-hmm.
Herschel just lost a lot of velocity, and he couldn't do the job. But there was never anybody better than him. And as a result, all I had to do was get myself into the sixth inning, seventh inning, and eighth or ninth inning or whenever, and do like they do now. We've lost our train of thought. When that alarm went off,
uh-huh.
Boom. That's like a pitcher looking in there. And he's thinking, I can get and strike him out with this. That ball in here, mm-hmm. You get the other pitch.
Well,
let me first explain about a manager. There's no book written for managers.
That's right.
You can describe what Stengel did. Mm-hmm. You can describe what Lopez did. And both of them are opposite types of managers. Or Cochran or McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that seems constant about managers is that they have their own coaches. They keep their coaches unless the coaches go on to become managers.
Hi. Don't get up.
How you doing? Glad to see you.
How are you?
Hope you're feeling better.
Oh, it's so stupid. I thought it was time to exit.
Wonderful. I would love to have some.
Okay, managing.
Yes. You're talking about the different personalities.
Yeah, you play the cards that they deal you. If you have a club that runs, you let them run. And if you have a club that's powerful, you get them in a position where they can use their power.
Mm-hmm.
That means that some of the guys on the ball club have to sacrifice themselves to get the big man up. They criticized the guy in Gene Mark,
mm-hmm.
in Minnesota for bunting. And Jim Leland does it all the time. Mm-hmm. He's got the shortstop, and every time the shortstop is up, they know he's going to bunt. And it works because he gets Bonds and Bonilla and all those guys up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he didn't have our second batter who could mm-hmm. do that, then he would play the game just a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
I'm giving credit where credit is due with this great manager, Leland. He recognizes that that's the way he has to play. If you gave him the ball club I had, and he might do the same thing. He might bunt to get a Bell, who was one of the most consistent hitters I've ever seen,
mm-hmm.
or Kluszewski up to the plate, or Wally Post. And certainly you would try to avoid a double play. You'd mm-hmm. use a hit and run. And you just let the ball players play and do what they can do best.
But that means that a manager's got to be insightful to know what they can do best.
That's right, and you can't do it in a broadcasting booth where you don't know these things. All they give you is 100 stats.
Well, yeah, you could.
And they put out all of the ifs, ands, mm-hmm. and buts. And no, you've got to know your men. You've got to know what they did, how they reacted.
Well, you just keep that in your head. I mean, you didn't have calculators and computers in those days.
Well,
you know, I guess you had charts that you...
Yeah, we had charts. Mm-hmm. We had... if you ran into trouble, I can remember one time we could not get the first baseman for the Baltimore Orioles. Couldn't get Boog Powell out, and so I told my general manager that we're having a lot of trouble getting this guy out. I'd like to have somebody go out and take a look at them, maybe help us. Well, he sent one of our scouts in to look at Powell play six games. And when we came in, he was waiting for me, and he's a great big guy that hits the ball 9 miles. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that you don't want him to do is to turn on a ball on you, and we didn't have a 90-mile-per-hour pitcher. So he said, Bertie, just pitch the ball in on him and play him with your infield as though he were a right-hand pull hitter. And I looked at him, I said, you got to be kidding. And he said, no, I'm not kidding. That he'll hit the ball at the second baseman or the shortstop if the ball is high in on him, mm-hmm. and in on him. Mm-hmm. But he'll pull anything from the middle of the plate out and hit it 9 miles. So I had a pitcher, Dick Donovan, who could had great control. And I told Dick what had been told to me, and he said, well, I'll give it a try. And the first time Boog was up, he was in a position where he could hurt us. And Donovan pitched him inside, and he hit the ball right at the second baseman. And the next time up, he hit the ball right at the second baseman. And it was just one of those things that it was unbelievable that a man as big and strong as he was could be pitched in the position where his power should be. And that's one of the reasons why a guy out in advance helps. Yeah. But he should only be out in advance and help where you needed help. You don't need help when you've got the guy from Boston pitching. You know, you don't need help with Morris pitching. You might need help with one hitter for Morris, and not for a whole ball club or somebody out there that doesn't.
When you went to, well, let me see, when you went up to Cincinnati, you took the place of one fantastic Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
Rogers Hornsby.
Yeah. Well,
and you did some, going back to that point, that you can be a Hall of Famer, but that doesn't mean you're going to be a successful manager. And you took a club out of second division and in 2 years almost winning the pennant.
Well, I you know, that's one of the things.
So you,
take a club. I managed the club.
Well,
and the ball players took us. You know,
maybe you're being too modest, Bertie.
No, I'm not being modest. In 1956, we had a chance to win it, and we went out and got help, and it got us into the final week of the season. And when the season was over, and we had drawn $1.2 million, and they had never drawn over $600,000, and everything was great. I spent half of my winter wondering what I could have done to make up the difference between winning and losing. I didn't know whether the ball club finished where it did in spite of me or because of me.
And over that winter, what'd you come up with?
I came up with a blank. I couldn't find out where we could have done anything different than what we did.
Well, your pitching staff was Nexall, who was 13-11, Johnny Klepstein, 12-11, Hirsch Freeman, 14-5, fantastic relief.
Yeah, that's the guy I'm talking about.
And a fellow by the name of Lawrence.
Bull Lawrence, he won about 20 games.
Yeah, 19-10.
That's right.
But, you know, you were up against the Dodgers, Don Newcomb, Sal Magley, Carl Erskine, Roger Craig. The Braves had Warren Spahn.
Wait a minute. They had I don't know when Joe Black was over with the Dodgers, but they had Joe Black.
Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah,
that's right. And they had Clem Levine was an outstanding reliever.
So your team was against some powerhouse of pitching staffs.
Oh, Milwaukee.
Yeah, you had Spahn. You had
Burdette. Burdette would beat me 5 times a year.
Bob and Buell?
Buell never pitched against us.
Oh.
Buell was a very effective guy against the clubs that Milwaukee had to beat.
And but they say pitching, that goes the old adage, pitching is the name of the game, no matter if you can hit 220 home runs a year?
Pitching is the name of a game. If you lose it, use it properly, you can abuse a pitching staff. You can, I hate to say that in 1956 we lost because of our pitching. Our guys, they were so great. They were happy. They did anything that you wanted them to do. They pitched whenever they were asked to pitch. I can't say that these guys, some of them were not pitchers, but I remember a meeting that Mr. Crosley had. He was the owner of the ball club with me and Gabe Paul. Mm-hmm. And he was very interested in whether we could win or not, and he said, "I'm not happy about the way your pitching is going, Bertie." And I said, "Well, neither am I." But I said, "They'll be all right. We'll make it." And he said, "What about your pitching coach?" And I suddenly froze, because my pitching coach was Tom Ferrick. And he was making every one of these guys better than they were. And they loved him. And I said, "Mr. Crosley, Tom Ferrick doesn't tell these guys what to do. I do. If there's anything wrong with the pitching staff, don't blame Ferrick. Blame me." Mm-hmm. And I got up and walked out of the room. Now, what I'm doing is blowing my job. Who owns the ball club? And I was in his home with Gabe Paul, and I waited in Gabe's car, and he came out, and he saw the car, and we started to drive back to the city, and